The roll call for you, Michele.
Please.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. On the call today, the IRTPB call on the 20th of April. We have Michele Nilon, Barbara Steele, James Bladel, Anil George, Michael Collins, Matt Serlin, Barry Cobb, and for staff we have Marika Koenig and Olaf Nordling. And Kevin Erdmann has sent regrets, he can't be on the call, and we have been trying to call out to Bodwan Shombi, but I think the weather conditions are very bad. I know that was the case yesterday for a certain call for him. Thank you, Michele. Over to you.
And I believe we had apologies from Mikey as well, yes?
And yes, you're quite right, and Mikey as well. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Right, good afternoon, everybody. We've got quite a busy agenda today, which is probably a good thing in some respects. Mass Mansell says he's going to try joining us later, but he sent his homework to the list yesterday. So I don't know if you all had a chance to look at that. I'm going to hand over to James now. James, you have the power.
Thank you. Hello, Michele, and hello, team. Just for transcription purposes, I wanted to point out that this is actually April 13th, and Paul Diaz joined, so not to be a stickler for detail, but I wanted to first apologize for sending the documentation so late on the list yesterday. My schedule really got away from me, and I spent most of the night working on cleaning this up. But what we have for review of this group are two documents. The first is a draft policy recommendation for an expedited transfer reverse policy, which would give a mechanism for the rapid undoing or urgent return of a inter-registrar transfer. There are certain conditions that must be met. There are certain restrictions that are recommended, but we can go through those in detail here in this call, and then I encourage everyone who hasn't had a chance to look at it to first apologize for giving you short notice and then ask for everyone to please take a look at that when you get a chance. The second document was a spreadsheet crudely and primitively following the example that Marika and staff give us is that I tried to collect all of the comments received when we circulated the draft policy document, and we received some very healthy comments from registries, from Barbara and some of the folks she talked to in the registry stakeholder group, other registrars, and I think the important thing here is that we discussed this with registrars in a variety of business models. And this was also reviewed by ICANN staff and ICANN's policy team. So I think we've tried to get a comprehensive review of the ideas being put forth into this policy recommendation. And some healthy comments were received. Some of them were so blatantly self-evident that we had overlooked them the first time that I went ahead and fixed the document. But other ones, I think, were a little more substantive, and we wanted to just kind of make a note of those recommendations and raise them for discussion within this group. So, Michele, my question is, do we want to dive into these in depth today? How do you want to proceed?
I think we need to – there were certain areas where we had – where I think you recognized that we needed to get some feedback from the group. So maybe if we were to kind of pick up on a couple of those.
Okay.
And then see how it goes. I mean, the thing, from my perspective personally, I think, you know, we need to keep momentum and keep moving, because otherwise, if we leave things go, kind of let's discuss this on the list, yada, 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 I know personally I will never get round to it. I'll have all the best intentions in the world, but I'll never do it.
That's a fair
and I'm
point.
Sure I'm not the only, I'm sure I'm not the only person like that.
Right. Okay, well, I think that the primary section that was raising a lot of questions that we felt probably would benefit from a group discussion were in Section 3. And I would ask if Marika could revert back to the draft document. I don't believe there's a way we can put both up simultaneously, so I apologize for that. Okay, thank you. And if everyone can take a look at this, I think Section 1 just kind of gives a bit of a background on the objective. Section 2 provides a background of the IRTP and some of the problems that we've encountered. And I think that the comments received in this area indicate that we probably need some help from staff as far as composing the historical sequence of how the IRTP came to be. I tried to do this, you know, just from the reading up of the policy, and I got some of the dates wrong, and then I think some folks pointed out some various corrections. So rather than do that again and get that wrong, I think that, you know, that's an area where I think staff could make a big contribution. But skipping down to Section 3, the procedure, this is where the meat and potatoes of the policy is described, the policy recommendation, sorry. And it's essentially, you know, we can go through this one line by line, but essentially, in a nutshell, the policy is a mechanism that's available to the pre-transfer registrar by the working on behalf of the pre-transfer registrant, which may or may not have changed. We'll get into that here in a little bit. And it is meant to cause the registry to reverse the transfer without awaiting any sort of action or being dependent upon any action from the new registrar. I think that's important, and we'll get into that here in just a moment. So starting with Section 3, 3.1, the expedited transfer reversal policy would be mandatory. It would be, if this recommendation is adopted, it would be a consensus policy alongside the IRTP and TDRP. The original registrar, the one that had the name prior to the transfer, would be referred to in the document as the pre-transfer registrar. And that's because when we start to say terms like gaining registrar and losing registrar, and then we want to reverse those terms, it gets very confusing. So I think that we standardize on a convention of calling them the pre-transfer registrar. The policy must be initiated within the 60 days of the completion of the transfer. Most registrars, although it is optional, most registrars will block a name against additional transfers for a period of 60 days once it's transferred into their management. And what we're trying to do here is prevent serial transfers. So, you know, we don't want a name hopping around to four registrars in the space of 2 months. Now, one of the key things that was pointed out about this policy is, this policy recommendation is that that is optional. Registrars would have to actively NAC a transfer request that came in during that cooling off window. And I think that, you know, we could probably benefit from some additional discussion here because one of the ideas that was floated around was using the registry lock status to for a period of 60 days to kind of remove that discretionary aspect from the registrar when it is fraudulent transfer. So maybe, Michele, I can stop there for a minute and see if there's any kind of a cue for questions on that particular aspect of this recommendation.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. Does anybody have any initial thoughts, or are you all completely so impressed with this wonderful document? Ah, good. Barbara's got a question. Yes, Barbara.
Hi, it's Barbara. I personally think that if the name should be locked down for the 60 days, then I think that probably should happen at the registrar level. And then, you know, then it's up to the registrar if they choose to unlock it. A lot of registrars already will lock down a domain name anyway, unless, you know, the registrant opts out of that. But I think it'd be better managed at the registrar level.
Okay. Anil?
Thanks. Good job. I just have a question and comment about two specific provisions. One is section 3.5. It talks about a fee to be charged to the registrant. Is that a single transaction fee for transfer?
Can we just kind of put a pin in that question for just a moment? I wanted to kind of open up for comments up to section 3.2.
Sure.
And then we can move to section 3.5, because I think that that is also an area that is ripe for further discussions.
Yep, that's fine.
Okay, what was your second one also in that section, or?
Yeah, also in that section about the 3.43, the indemnification provision.
Okay. I'm making a note here about fee and indemnification. I'm putting Anil's name next to it, and when we get to that, I will definitely remember to pick on you.
Okay.
Mass?
Thanks, Michele. First off, just want to compliment the members of the sub-team that put this together. This is actually a really good document, so thanks, guys, for the work on this. Just to kind of pick up on what Barbara said, you know, I think I in general, would agree with that in that it should be handled at the registrar level. The only hesitation I have is that then we're essentially pushing the problem onto ICANN compliance at that point, because if you have registrars that aren't following the policy, then, you know, it becomes a compliance issue, and that is a lot more difficult to manage and enforce than the GTLD registries. And so, you know, I don't know if David Geezer's on the line or not, but it might be something worth sort of diving into a little more, because, I agree that it should be mandatory. We should do away with it being optional, and I think if that's the case, then registries, frankly, are probably in a better position to manage that and use not just the registrar lock status, but a server lock status, I would think, for the first 60 days after transfer.
Okay, I went ahead and put myself in the queue, Michele, if that's all right.
All right, work away.
Yeah, so I just wanted to say I agree with Matt specifically, and Barbara, although raises some very valid points. You know, there could be unforeseen scenarios in which, you know, all parties, the pre-transfer registrar, the post-transfer registrar, and the registry working together may want to do something during that 60-day period and, you know, would be constrained from action. I do want to point out, however, that we're in the narrowest scope of an unauthorized or fraudulent transfer. You know, the gaining or the registrar that it was moved to was probably selected either because it's a small registrar, a one-man shop, an overseas registrar that maybe is not as communicative or doesn't have a 24-hour staff. So the folks who are hijacking domain names know exactly which registrars to target and, more importantly, which registrars to avoid. And so I think that anything that requires them to, you know, lock or, as Matt was saying, requires their compliance with the policy, while it may be more flexible, it does leave vulnerabilities in place that we're currently seeing today. So I kind of see both sides of the value of this, but I think that in general we're all saying that this 60 days should be mandatory and not optional. And there's Barbara.
Hi, Barbara. I think that if you're going to make it a mandatory lock after 60 days from a transfer, then it probably should be universal throughout the transfer policy. So, you know, I personally would prefer to see that as being mandatory across the board versus just mandatory in this particular circumstance. You know, to the extent that you would want the registries to manage that process, I can say from VeriSign's perspective that, you know, we do have a systematic restriction on transfers for 60 days from the initial registration of a domain name. So it's not inconceivable that, you know, we could restrict transfers for 60 days after, you know, any type of transfer. But I guess, you know, obviously that's not going to restrict them from necessarily changing any other information, and it also would require development. So, you know, it would be one of those things that registry operators would need to determine when they could get it in their roadmaps for development. So whatever way you wish to go, I think that if you're asking for the registry operators to manage this in any way, shape, or form, then it needs to be something that can be done systematically. But that will, as I said, require development, and it would have to, you know, obviously be discussed with the individual registries to determine, you know, what resources they have to be able to do that.
Okay. Perhaps the best way forward for Section 321 is to essentially capture both options, one being that this is managed at the registry level, one being managed at the registrar level, and then maybe point out that there are some trade-offs that have to be made for each choice. And let's maybe table that for today and move on, but recognize that we have a couple of different ways to actually implement this idea that the 60-day transfer lock should be mandatory. There's Marika.
Yeah, this is Marika. And just to add, like, if indeed on different items you have maybe different options, that might be a way as well for the public comment period to have some more broader input on it. Just want to point out that, you know, this group doesn't necessarily have to resolve all the issues before putting this into the report as a proposed recommendation, but it might as well leave some of those questions open and ask specifically for comments on those where there are indeed different options or possibilities to consider.
That's an excellent point. There may be something that we're missing as well. There may be a third option that we're not considering. So. Okay. Well, if I can move on to section, and thank you, and if we can capture those different potential remedies, then maybe we can just move on to section 3.3. And there was 3.3 and 3.4 were probably the area where we received the bulk of the comments. And this is essentially regarding some sort of an authorization or documentation from the pre-transfer registrar to, you know, that they would obtain from the registrant and then submit that to the registry when requesting an ETRP action. So Section 3.3 essentially says that there must be an authorization, and this authorization has to come from the registrant. Cannot come from the admin contact. We're trying to kill a couple of different birds with one stone here. We're trying to ensure first that registrars are acting on behalf of a registrant, that they're not doing this unilaterally. Secondly, we're trying to provide a mechanism that is exclusive to the registrant, that the admin contact does not have, is not available to the admin contact. And meaning that this is a mechanism by which we could potentially resolve this in the most straightforward cases. I know we got into some complex discussions last week, but in the most you know, common cases where a registrant and an admin contact disagree, the policy states that the admin contact has the ability to override, or I'm sorry, the registrant has the admin the ability to override the admin contact. But what we're saying is that there's an uneven application of this out in the real world. So this would standardize the way those disagreements are handled. I know it doesn't address everything that Michael was raising on the call last week, but I think it's a start in that direction.
Could we just pause for 1 second there, James?
Yes, pausing on Section
3.3. Yeah, no, just, I think we just don't need to rush through this too quickly because, personally, it gets a bit confusing. Does anybody have any questions on what James has talked about up to now? Is there anything which is unclear or anything that anybody needs clarification on, disagrees with? No comments? Okay, continue, James.
Okay, thanks, Michele. Moving on to Section 3.4, this is where we kind of start to burden the staff a little bit. So we essentially say that staff is asked to develop, in collaboration with a working group or sub-team, an authorization form. And we've listed out some of the elements that should be included in this authorization. This is not to be confused with the FOA that is spelled out in the IRTP. And I think that initially we started to go down that route and we were just confusing the heck out of people. So we backed off a little bit from that and said we need to create a separate authorization form specific to this EETRP policy recommendation. So the authorization would have a few elements. The first is that would be an affirmation or declaration that the transfer was unauthorized and that the registrant desires to reverse the transfer and restore it to its pre-IRTP status, and that the pre-transfer registrar is executing this policy on their behalf. So the first part is a declaration and a, one might say a delegation. 3.4.2 says the documentation that the pre-transfer registrar has verified the identity of the registrant. And we didn't want to get too prescriptive here because this could vary quite a bit from different jurisdictions, but essentially you want to understand that you have the registrar knows who they're talking to and that that person is who they claim to be. 3.4.3, and I've got a note here next to Anil's name, but 3.4.3 is that the PTR would be indemnified by the registrars. This is important. Registrars probably would be reluctant to wade into this area unless they felt that they had some cover. And I'm going to get through 3.4.4, and then I'm going to jump to Anil. We'll just consider him in the queue already. And then 3.4.4 essentially says that all these materials plus any supporting documentation will be bundled into an ETRP packet. So what elements does anyone have any questions about, and what elements are we missing? Let's throw open the floor on Section 3.4. Anil, did you want to go first since you...
Sure. I just wanted to ask you on the indemnification provision, it's what kind of issues do you anticipate for which the pre-transfer registrar would need to be indemnified? What kind of liability do you think would you really be concerned about?
I think there's a few, I think if I had a good answer to that, we wouldn't be requesting indemnification. I think there's an unanticipated degree of risk when a registrar that a registrar would assume in executing this, policy. For example, the registrant may be lying. Maybe they've forged the identification documents. There could be another layer of criminality or bad behavior occurring here, like there is with just about everything in this industry, that would open the registrar up to exposure of liability with regard to the person who has the name now, the sponsoring registrar that is on the losing end of the reversal. So there's just a lot of different parties that could be affected if the pre-transfer registrant is, pulling a con.
Yeah, I understand. I think those are all valid things to consider, no question. My concern is, I think if you're talking about a registrant, is a legitimate registrant who's trying to use this policy to avoid some hijacker, they're already in a vulnerable position. So I don't know that it's quite fair to them. There has to be some type of balance, I think. I'm not saying that you shouldn't necessarily be indemnified, but I think there has to be a little more balance so that the indemnification is not so open-ended as to cover all things. I think, if the particular concern is there might be a fraud, someone posing as as the authentic registrant, then we should qualify the indemnification language to say that the pre-transfer registrar is indemnified, with respect to anyone posing, you know, by anyone posing as the registrant when that is, when it's uncovered as, you know, as fraudulent. Or, you know, I think we need some more qualification to just balance it out. I recognize that there are concerns that the registrar has, but I think it should be more balanced and not so open-ended.
Okay, that's a good point, and we could probably have some additional legal assistance here. I don't believe there were any lawyers on our sub-team, so, you know, we could probably, if, you know, mark this area for additional work. Barbara was next.
Yeah, this is Barbara. It's going to make Anil happy, but the registry operators would also be looking for some indemnification here as well, because we're obviously the ones that are going to be actually affecting the transfer back to the PTR. So I think that whatever is determined is an appropriate level of indemnification. I think it should also apply to the registries.
I have a question regarding that, Barbara. I don't disagree with you, but I think that there was some discussion in our sub-team about whether or not that was, you know, for lack of a better term, built into the fact that this would become a consensus policy. But you're saying additional explicit protections in this section for the registry would probably be a good thing to add?
I think it would be a easier sell to the registries.
Okay, good idea. And since I'm kind of managing the queue here, I will call on our chair, McKinley.
Yeah, I'm just this entire thing of indemnification. I think we should be, the thing is, if everybody can agree that some kind of level of indemnification should be there. I mean, the main thing is, I understand where Anil's coming from. You don't want to end up in a situation where some, and this was something that we discussed in our own deliberations on this as well. You know, you don't want to end up like kind of kicking somebody when they're down. The thing that we are afraid of is somebody trying to game the system. If for example, let's say they sell a domain at an auction or in some kind of aftermarket transaction, and then realize they could have made 10 times that amount of money if they'd been a bit shrewder about it. So you need to make sure that that kind of thing isn't allowed to happen, that somebody isn't going to be tempted to use this. Like, it's a bit like, say, you know, using the chargeback mechanism with your credit card company instead of going back to the company you bought something from and asking them for a refund. You know, it shouldn't be, you know, it would be abusive. But I don't think we should get too bogged down the exact terms of this. If everybody agreed there should be some kind of indemnification, then we can get thrash out some kind of wording that makes most people happy.
That's a good point,
Michele. Anil? Yeah, I agree with you on that. And that balance should be, you know, should include, one, the issues that you guys are raising, which are very valid. And then we just want to also make sure that if this is a policy that we're positing for registrants, we want to make sure that they'll hopefully make use of it and won't shy away because of a fear that if they, you know, if they make use of it, they're going to have, you know, an extremely heightened liability because they're going to be responsible for everything. So, again, you know, with your comments in mind, we have to balance that.
Okay. Can we move on then to Section 3.5 with a note that the subject of indemnification needs additional work for determining what the appropriate indemnification should be, but that all parties that are assuming some degree of risk should expect some degree of protection under this policy recommendation. Okay, we'll move on to Section 3.5, and I also have a note here for Anil, which is that the pre-transfer registrar may, at their discretion, charge a registrant a fee to reverse a name. We're really trying to, again, strike a balance here. There is a cost involved. There is additional work. There is additional risk, as we mentioned. But we also don't want to see registrars who have a registrant coming to them holding a name for ransom, you know, because someone's been hijacked and taking advantage of the registrant that's under duress. So we're really trying to effect a balance here by saying that, yes, they have the expectation to charge a recovery fee. However, that should be in line with whatever their standard transfer fees would be. And I'm just going to point out that we have now multiple registrars, and at least three of them are on the U.S., so we can't say anything in regard to pricing necessarily. We're going to be very uncomfortable with that. But I think that it is something to point out that we think that there should be some sort of a fee associated with this service, but it should not be onerous or completely open-ended for the registrar to, as McKelly said, kick the registrant when he's down. So with that, I think we can jump to Anil if it's quick, but looks like we have a queue building up here.
Sure. I'll be brief. I'm not necessarily opposed to a fee, but I guess I have a question and a comment. One is, maybe I'll make the comment first. In a fraud situation, do you think it's fair to impose a fee or expect a fee from the registrant when the registrant is just trying to make use of a policy to correct something that they were not responsible for? So that's just a general question. The comment would be, if we end up including a fee, I think there should be just, you know, more clarity to the registrant to let them know, is it a single fee? How will it work? How is it assessed? I think there should be just more particular information so that the registrant knows up front, okay, here's what I can expect.
Okay. Chris?
Yes. Hi, Chris Chappell speaking. Well, the UDRP has a fee, doesn't it? It's significantly more than what we're talking about here. What always surprises me in these conversations, and I sort of tip my hat to the registrars, actually, for what is a very small sum of money, you know, $10, $20 or euros or whatever, in these situations, sorting some of these messes out, you've got a lot of work, isn't there? And you know, from a pure business point of view, looking at a particular case, you're spending a lot more time. That is sort of a guaranteed loss-making situation. With that in mind, if here in 3.5 we're talking about the fee for one-year domain registration, then almost there's an argument not to bother with this at all because, you know, it's nothing, is it? Thank you.
That's a good point, Chris. In fact, later on in the document, we do recommend that the year that was added to the expiration be retained. The year that was added to the expiration during the fraudulent transfer be preserved, just to ensure that the name doesn't expire through this process. So it's not like they're getting nothing to show for their fee for this recovery. And it is a deterrent to some degree, Anil, to ensure that this is only used in those cases where it is legitimate hijack. Barbara's up next.
Hi, it's Barbara. I obviously think that it's fair that registrars be permitted to charge a fee associated with the service. I can speak from the registry perspective that, and the supplemental rules is where the registries typically designate what their fee is under the TDRP for level one dispute resolution. And, you know, perhaps to the extent that this is incorporated into either the TDRP or into a separate consensus policy that kind of hangs from the IRTP, perhaps the registrars also be permitted to have supplemental rules, if you will, on, you know, their implementation of the particular policy, which would also give them the opportunity to define whatever the fees are associated with providing that service.
Okay, so good point.
Mikhail? Hi. Kaylee here. Thinking about the fees, the kind of thing we were trying to get a balance from, I mean, from my perspective, again, it's a case of, you know, not wanting to kick the registrant when they're down, et cetera, et cetera. If, for example, the issue, the hijack, the problem was caused by some sort of failing on the registrar's side, which can happen. I'm sorry, you know, you're dealing with software, you're dealing with computers. No matter how big or how much you're doing using a particular system, things can go wrong. The thing I would like was looking for was something where there was a discretionary element to it, that I wouldn't be in a situation where I'd be forced to charge a registrant if the issue was caused by something on our end. However, if, for example, the registrant has used a particularly weak password, has handed over every single bit of their personal information which was solicited via phishing email, and, you know, are just generally done things which are very ill-advised, then, you know, I don't see why, you know, they should get away with that scot-free, that they can get this kind of, you know, get-out-of-jail-free card. They need to pay for that at some level. That was just my thoughts on it.
Oh, I'm in total agreement with that, Michele. In fact, I was thinking that, you know, what about the cases where someone has used a free email service to register names and their entire portfolio is hijacked? You know, there has to be some sort of there has to be some sort of an economic cost for something like that. But again, leaving it discretionary so that the registrar can opt to, you know, absorb that fee as a cost if they recognize that it was a shortcoming in their system that allowed the hijack to happen. So it's about balance, like you were saying. Michael?
Yes. I think it's a nominal fee, especially considering the fact that a year is added to the registration. In fact, I think it's so nominal that I doubt it's much of a deterrent. But I would like to back up, because it reminded me or made me think of something related to the indemnification that I might like to add. I think that we should specifically not require the registrant to be responsible for just expenses that might be related to processing this if it's not turned out to be fraudulent, if it turns out to be a bona fide hijacking and the registrant is, you know, seeking a valid return, then I think indemnification should specifically not include any expenses, since I suppose that could be assumed. Thank you.
Okay, that's a good point. And maybe we can make a note there for our further work on the indemnification section. I think with the fee and with indemnification, I think Anil hit on the two elements that are going to impose a bit of a burden on the registrant. The idea here is that while we wanted to create a useful tool to address hijacking, we didn't want to inadvertently design the world's greatest reverse hijacking mechanism. I think we're just trying to balance all the interests of all the folks involved. So the queue's empty. Michele, with your permission, I'll move on to Section 3.6.
Oh, please do. You're doing a wonderful job.
Okay, so with Section 3.6, we start to spell out what's going to happen when the ETRP packet is submitted. We mentioned that there's a 48-hour window for the registry to effect some changes, specifically to restore the original PTR as the registrar of record. Now, the 48-hour bit was admittedly a little arbitrary. There are some folks that pointed out that if you have a revenue-generating website, a lot of harm can occur in 48 hours. On the other hand, we recognize that while VeriSign and Afilias and Neustar and a lot of the larger registries would be able to, for lack of a better description, push a button and make this change happen almost instantaneously, some of the smaller registries would have trouble automating a system like this. So open to suggestions or comments on what an appropriate time frame should be. I think that, you know, we want to preserve the expedited and rapid or urgent level of action that's called for in this policy recommendation, but we certainly don't want to make life impossible for the registries to comply. So any thoughts on that? Mr. Sterling.
Thanks, James. Yeah, you know, I can appreciate that, you know, we don't want to create a burden on folks, but I think this is a case where we need to actually apply the highest common denominator and not the lowest. So I think 48 hours is too long. I think 24 probably would be more reasonable, frankly. And it is something that we should expect, you know, not just today's registry operators to do, but, you know, registry operators in the next 2, 3, 5, 10 years to be able to do when there's a clear case of hijacking, to be able to respond and you know, return it back within 24 hours, I think is reasonable.
Yeah, I like that statement that you said about applying the highest common denominator rather than the lowest. I wonder if we can maybe capture that in here somewhere. Michaela?
I like Matt's idea as well about the highest versus the lowest. I think that's a good idea. The only thing is practicalities. That's what I'm a bit concerned with. You know, an organization like VeriSign or Afilias is 24/7, 365. They might not be overly impressed with having something like a 24-hour turnaround or something imposed on them, but I'm sure they could manage to cope with it. The thing that concerns me is that if we end up in a situation further down the road where, let's say, for example, .eus goes live for the Basque country, and, you know, it's probably not going to be a particularly large TLD. 24 hours, they could. Will they actually have staff working all the time to be able to do that? It's something I would wonder about.
Yeah, that's a good point. Barbara?
Hi, it's Barbara. I think to the extent that, you know, you're expecting a very, very tight turnaround time period as well, and I don't disagree that, you know, in the case of a hijacking, a lot of money can be at stake if a domain name is down. I think that you need to kind of qualify it that, you know, it's basically upon receipt of a complete invalid ERTP package, then the registry will act. Because obviously if there's information that's not included in there that may be missing that would, I guess, deem it an incomplete package, then we would want the option to be able to come back and say we still need this documentation or the FOA or whatever it's going to be.
Okay, so not just in necessarily how long the timer runs, but when do we actually start the clock?
Exactly.
Okay, good catch. Matt?
Yeah, no, I agree 100% with what Barbara said. I think it's important to add that clarification. You know, just to pick up on what Michaela said, and again, you know, I'm sensitive to it, and I see where you're going with it, but I guess the counter argument to that is, to me, it doesn't matter, and it shouldn't matter, frankly, the size of the TLD. If it's, you know, a TLD with 50 million domains registered, or if it's a TLD with 5,000, if someone has a mission-critical site that's operating in that TLD that gets hijacked, you know, the standard ought to be the same across the board. And I think it's incumbent upon ICANN to make sure that registry operators are able to perform at the same level. And so, you know, if you have 5,000 domains and you have to have a guy on call 24/7, 365, then that's what you do. If you're VeriSign and you have people sitting in an office 24/7, that's what you do. But I still think it's incumbent upon us to make sure that the expectation is the same for everyone. And I'm not saying, Michaela, that you were saying that it wasn't, but I think we should really, I think this is something that we should to stick to and push for 24 hours, frankly.
Thanks, Matt. We'll give Michaela the last word on this one, and then if we could move on, that'd be great.
Yeah. I don't disagree with Matt. I suppose the thing that I was kind of, was something which was sitting in the back of my head was the actual back-end operators for the TLDs, for the registries, regardless of the size, unless something very strange happens, I can see a situation arising where you're going to end up with, say, maybe 10 or 20 companies globally that are going to be running backends for hundreds of TLDs. So I would assume that the backend operators will have staff. it's just something maybe we need, maybe just to take that into consideration. I mean, I don't disagree with what Matt is saying. I'm just trying to see how you can do something in such a manner that you don't end up putting an unnecessary burden on a community TLD or something like that. Because, yeah, Matt's perfect, he's completely right, but at the same time, what's the likelihood? I mean, there's a whole range of different things there. But we're talking about stuff that could have an impact on people's contracts, so we have to be careful.
Agreed. Okay, and just a little bit of a note between 361 and the old 362s. We originally had all these different actions that we're going to request of the registry to occur, but I think Barbara and some of the folks she chatted with on the registry stakeholder group pointed out that there could be scenarios in which we wouldn't want the registry to implement these changes, but we wanted to provide more flexibility to the registrar. I think we reached a consensus that once the registry restores the pre-transfer registrar as the registrar of record, then they're free to make whatever subsequent changes are required to fit that scenario or situation, and we wouldn't necessarily handcuff the registries into making those changes, which conceivably some of the registrars might have to undo. So we struck those recommendations as well. So that's the end of 3.6. 3.7, we had another bit here about, the 48-hour window here, which I think we've covered. We had some additional actions required, one that the registry would notify the new registrar that the transfer was fraudulent and that it was reversed, and that they would use the appropriate urgent communication channel, whether that's email or a poll message. They would refund the transaction fee. Obviously, if I'm a registrar and I've received a transfer that was reversed, I don't feel like I should have to pay for that. But they would assess an equivalent fee to the pre-transfer registrar. And this is, again, a cost-offsetting idea that the registry should be able to, because this is a manual process and requires some development, there should be some ability for them to recover their costs. And this is, of course, driving the fee discussion we had earlier about the registrar. But here's an important consideration. 374, when this hijacking occurred as part of all transfers, an additional year is added to the expiration not to exceed the 10-year maximum, or I'm sorry, whatever the maximum is, not to exceed that. We want to preserve that additional time on the registration. And the key element here is that, this process could conceivably step over boundaries of grace periods and expirations that would really complicate and confuse this policy recommendation. So what we see in a lot of other policies, with the transfer policy is to avoid this, is that extra year is added as part of, so there's a renewal as part of the transfer. And I think that that renewal should be part of this policy transfer as well and should be preserved. I think we're all open to ideas on how we could remove that without introducing a whole lot of contingencies about expiration and grace periods. But I think that this is really just the most straightforward approach. Barbara?
Hi, Barbara. I can say from VeriSign's perspective that the tool that we will use will preserve the year. The only thing that we would change would be the registrar of record. We would prefer not to have to remove that year because obviously it would require additional work on our part to develop a mechanism by which to do that. I can say, however, though, even if we were to remove the year, at the next time we run an auto-renew batch job, it's going to pick up that domain name, and it's going to auto-renew it anyway. So I really don't think there's danger of the domain name, expiring from that perspective. But just to be clear, I like the fact that we just leave the year alone and not touch it. With regard to the fees associated with it, I can say from our perspective, we have a mechanism that's available if the registrars are cooperative with one another and they just need us at the registry to reverse a transfer. We have, and I think I've discussed it in previous calls that we've had, the application for reinstatement of sponsorship, and because that's such a mouthful, we'll call it ARS. And in that particular case, we actually charge less per domain name than we do to actually transfer domain names. So I think we'd want flexibility on the pricing on that, because we don't want to have to charge whatever the going rate is for a transfer.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're open to lower fees.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously anything that we would do, and I'm assuming anything that the other registries would do in their implementation of this, is they would define whatever the fees are within their supplemental rules, and it would be very clear. And I personally can't imagine that it would be an onerous fee.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And I think here we're making it at least, if not a requirement, we're putting a stick in the mud for start of negotiations that, you know, the reversal fee shouldn't start at $1,000 and then talk them down from there. We want to keep it in line with some of the other fees. So those are really good comments. Michael?
Hold on, I'm having trouble with my mute button again. Thank you. I see that we have a notice for what the registry should do after the reversal, but there isn't any instructions for what the registrar should do to preserve the status of this domain, to preserve the domain in case there is a dispute. In case there's a dispute about this being a fraudulent transfer that was then reversed. And there's no due process included that I see for the losing registrar or possibly a losing registrant, in case that registrant is different than the one that initiated the reversal.
Michael, you touched on a subject that is took up a big chunk of our discussions with other registrars and on the subgroup. I think there's some mention of it down below, but I would concede that we need more work in that area. If we can move to Section 4 and just talk about restrictions, and essentially this would be prohibitions on where... Oh, sorry, Barbara, did you...
Sorry about that. Yeah, I actually just wanted to add to that. I know that we had taken out the registry, reverting the name back to the registrant and the name servers and all of that. So you may want to add that back in as a registrar responsibility, because I think now that it's kind of silent, and I think that it probably should be clear that the registrar would be able to take those actions once the name is back in their control.
Okay, that's a good point. So we're talking about Section 3.6. Two, those areas that we crossed out, we might want to figure out which of those we have now delegated to the registrar, so we want to require, for example, 3.6.2, the second iteration of 3.6.2, restoring the contact data.
Correct.
Okay. As a registrar responsibility.
Exactly.
So moving into Section 4, where we discuss some of the restrictions and limitations of the policy, we wanted to make sure that the ETRP is not used to reverse transfers that were the result of implementing a UDRP decision. It's not eligible for names that are pending UDRP decisions or the subject of UDRP complaints. So we don't want our policies working against each other. We didn't want it to be, you know, names that were part of a bulk transfer were not eligible, or names that were part of an ICANN-sponsored reallocation associated with, like, the termination of accreditation. We didn't want folks using this policy to muddy up that process. And I think that any name that is involved in pending litigation would also be off limits, but I think that raises the question of how will the registrar and registry be made aware of that, and that's probably something that we need to develop as well. Once transfer has been reversed, the pre-transfer registrar has the name back again. They may deny future transfer requests for a period of 60 days. Again, just inserting a bit of a cooling off period to ensure that if there is any dispute over the transfer itself or the reversal of the transfer, that this thing is not going to hop around the globe, that we will have an opportunity to address those. I see Neil's hand up, but I just want to get through 4.3, and then we can kind of address the queue here on this entire section. 4.3 essentially touches on what Michael was saying, was that this is really an urgent correction mechanism and not meant to be a dispute resolution policy. So if the registrar registrant who or registrar who lost the name as a result of this reversal feels that, hey, this wasn't a hijack, this was a legitimate commercial transaction, or this was a legitimate transfer, and I challenge the information that's in the ETRP, and I challenge the claims of the registrant. We just want to mention that this policy no longer applies and it needs to escalate to, Barbara mentioned ARS or other registry-specific services, UDRP, and then, of course, everyone retains their right to go to court. Section 4.4 discusses that the pre-transfer registrar, in the case where they notice that someone may be potentially abusing this system, may block this policy from use by certain registrants or entities if they feel that a certain name or a certain individual is abusing the system, and then instead refer them to some of the other processes and procedures and remedies that are outlined in Section 4.3. So let's throw open. We don't have a lot of time, but we're really rolling downhill now. So we throw that out to the queue for Section 4, and we can start with Anil.
Yeah, thank you. I just have a quick question on the bulk transfer. I'm presuming your goal here is to not block an entire group of domains that are being transferred, but if among them there is one, either knowingly or unknowingly, that is part of a hijack, is that still subject to this process, or is there a way to allow that if that occurs?
Honestly, I don't think that's a scenario we had considered, Anil. So, maybe we should probably make a note of that and discuss that as we go forward.
I think that the bulk transfer, James, that's a particular type of transfer which would be special. Like, for example, the VeriSign allow for a partial bulk transfer, where, for example, you could decide to move a few thousand .coms from one registrar to another registrar in one fell swoop.
But McKinley, doesn't that also presume that the registrar that was losing a bulk or partial bulk transfer was well, now we're getting into the part three or of IRTP or part B. I think that's a longer conversation. I don't know.
I think it's a complicated conversation, but I don't think the bulk transfer, the reason why we've listed it there is it's not like a bulk transfer made by an end user. In other words, let's say, for example, Anil, that I have 20 domains with GoDaddy that I want to move to Black Knight, because Black Knight are wonderful and GoDaddy aren't.
Okay.
Sorry, James, I had to do that. So let's say I'm moving all 20 or 50 or even 100 or maybe even 1,000 as a registrant. That's not the bulk transfer that we were talking about.
Okay.
It's more the bulk transfer being done at a different level, if you follow me, between registrar to registrar, or transfers at a different, using a different process.
Okay. Maybe it's a matter to clarify for the registrant who's going to make use of this process to know that they're not precluded from using the process for the former bulk process that you were saying this is not concern.
Well, the thing with all this stuff, Anil, is we're trying to make it clear that this is for a narrow set of circumstances.
Right. No, but consistent with that, it might be helpful to just clarify that it does not it does not push you out of the process if you're talking about a bulk transfer, not at this higher level that you guys are talking about, but a more ordinary one.
Oh, okay.
Anil,
I see what she means. Yeah.
I think that's a good point. And originally we had listed out several different flavors of bulk transfers, and I think it was one of the recommendations in the spreadsheet that we just consolidate them all under the heading of bulk transfer. But if in doing that we've introduced confusion, then perhaps we should break them back out.
Yeah, that might be helpful, because I think you're talking about registrants that don't have the same level of sophistication that the registries and registrars have, so they're going to think of this as a term of art in their parlance.
Okay. Can we go to Michael?
Thank you. I think that coming back to the comments I made before, maybe this is the place we can address them. 4.2, we talk about may the registrar may elect to deny future transfers. I think that we need to require the registrar to deny transfers, because I think as a part of locking this up and in enabling the other registrar to dispute this for another registrant, we need to keep it from slipping away into multiple transfers, because it could be the person that initiated this that committed a fraud, not the person at the other end. So I think that what we had talked about when we initially started talking about an expedited process was one that would just bring the domain back to its original state while a dispute could be heard, if there was a dispute. I think that would require it to be locked. And I think that in 4.3, we probably need to address more specifically how to dispute that this was a fraudulent or erroneous transfer that was that ended up being reversed through this process. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Michael, and we'll note that. Olaf?
Yeah, just a very brief comment. I think that in order not to overburden the document, there are probably plenty of explanations that can be, at one point in time, put into some kind of explanatory notes rather than being part of the policy itself. For all the clarifications to be on board and such, otherwise you may need to come up with a number of I'm thinking about 4.3, for example, that we're mentioning the other remedies in such cases, and so I think that's typically a case for something that would you like to put in explanatory notes for further informing those who are reading it. Rather than having it as part of the actual policy document.
That's a good point.
That's a thought. Perhaps not right now, but in due course, so you get as crisp and clear language in the policy document as possible.
Well, and I think that's a good point, and it also does not limit us to new mechanisms that pop up in the future that aren't specifically or explicitly called out in this document. So it's a good idea not to have them in here necessarily.
Because if you have it in the policy itself, it becomes cast in stone, and it's very difficult to change. So.
Very quickly, I want to wrap this up here. I know we're a few minutes over, but Section 5 indicates there's some roles for ICANN as well, and I'll just kind of let folks take a look at that. But, they should publicize this policy, make sure that registrars are complying with it, and they might also ask registries to report on its use. I didn't want to dive too deeply in there because there is a potential for either a Section 6 or an overall discussion, which I want to, recognizing the time, I want to make sure we don't dive into today, but this idea that has come up on the sub-team and it came up a little bit today that this policy itself could be abused and could introduce new wrinkles or concerns into the domain investors community. And, you know, personally, I have a couple of thoughts here. One is that, you know, when you put the various harms on one side of the scale, I think that the harm that's occurring now likely is disproportionately higher than the harm that would be created by potential folks looking to, you know, cause trouble in the domain investors market. And secondly, I think, you know, especially with recent high-profile hijackings, you know, I would hope that the folks in that community would see the value in cleaning up the bad actors in that area, so that folks know that they're not purchasing hijacked domains. And I think that is probably going to have to be the selling point to that community of this policy, is that you know, trust and confidence in what it is that you believe that you're buying, as opposed to worrying about what might additional delays or documentation might be required when you're a seller. So I think that hopefully that we can state that in such a way, either in a Section 6 or in an overarching introduction, to make that a little more palatable so that we can get the support of that community. And with that, we have reached the end of this document. We're 9 minutes over. So, Michele, do we want to adjourn for today and then hope that we have a spirited discussion on the list?
I think we should respect people's afternoons. Do people want to continue on? I don't think, or do they want to drop off, or how are they fixed?
Yeah, I've got another call I've got to run to, so I need to drop off.
Chris, I've got to drop off this time. Thanks.
Okay. Well, look, how about this? We've got this. People can have a look over the documents that James sent out, and we can pick up next week. Would that work for everybody?
Yep.
Yep.
Okay.
That's great.
That's good.
Okay, and then we could take it from there. James, are you dashing off this minute, or can I grab you?
Can you give me 10 minutes for a biological, and then yes, I'm at your disposal.
Yeah, yeah, perfect. Thanks. TMI is the correct phrase I think I'm looking for. Okay, thanks everybody, and to speak to you all next week.
Yes.
Thanks.
Thanks, Shirley.
Thanks. Bye-bye.